This is the Voice of Freedom.
This is my happening and it freaks me out.
Never before since Jamestown and Plymouth Rock has our American civilization been in such danger as now.
In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
Jesus was black, Ronald Reagan was the devil, and the government is lying about 9/11.
The government, they the biggest monster. That's what we study. Governments.
Everybody's scared of the government, you know what I'm saying?
Politics is nothing but war without bloodshed, and war is nothing but politics with bloodshed.
Like 1984.
Does it look like stable thoughts go through my mind?
God damn America!
Having that dream where you made the white people riot, weren't you? How many times have I told you you better not even dream about telling white folks the truth?
We need to open our eyes. Our government doesn't give a shit.
This is about your life and mine. We're losing our freedom. And this isn't something that's going on far away. This isn't something that's happening places we can't do anything about it. It's happening right here.
And I will strike down upon thee with great vengeance and furious anger those who attempt to poison and destroy my brother.
The enemy should be in no doubt that we are his nemesis and we are bringing about his rightful destruction.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
We're going to South Carolina and Oklahoma and Arizona and North Dakota and New Mexico. We're going to California and Texas and New York. And we're going to South Dakota and Oregon and Washington and Michigan. And then we're going to Washington, D.C. to take back the White House!
Thank you for your time and good night.
What is the haps, Hap Cadets, Cats, and Kittens? It's the Higgity Higgity host with the most, Moxie O'Brien, back again with another episode of Come and See here on another Friday morning in America. And I've gotten some notifications from some of the members of the Hap cult that their t-shirts have arrived. I am overjoyed. I also want to start out by saying that I know I told you we were talking about the Freemasons today. This is not going to happen. So those of you who've been listening to the show for a while may recall that I've said on numerous occasions, I fucking hate secret societies and mystery schools and all that shit. I find it to be absolutely breathtakingly god-awful boring, and trying to force myself to read, 800 years worth of Freemason history in 5 days. Just, I'm sorry, I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. I don't care that much. You know, I can shorthand it for you. Every time you hear a conspiracy theorist say Freemason, they mean Jews. You're welcome. We'll cover it eventually, I promise. Just not right now. I don't have it. It doesn't fit with the, hey, so the CIA is the real problem, overarching theme of season 4, and it was just, holy fucking shit, how does anybody have the time? Like, you understand that Freemasons were just, it's a secret society of stonemasons is where it came from, right? It's just cats who like to cut rocks and made a whole weirdo thing with funny jackets and ceremonial sabers, and a Bible has to be open for business to be official, but you don't actually have to believe in the Bible, it's not a religious institution. Okay, there's a lot of weird things going on in there, and we can acknowledge that a lot of terrible people have been Freemasons. George Washington, for example. You know, several of the founding fathers, the KKK was part of, was sort of an offshoot, in a manner of speaking, of Freemasonry, like a lot of other terrible things. But I don't want to. I'm sorry. but while I was getting my toe into looking into Freemason stuff for the episode that I'm now not going to do, I had been looking at, as I always kind of am, the Patriot Militia movement, because as many of you are aware, that's sort of my bread and butter in a lot of ways. Like, yes, I think that I spend a lot of time studying fascism and American white supremacy and those kinds of things. But what's always been the most fascinating period in time to me is that period from like the 70s to the early 2000s, kind of culminating in Columbine, but then you could extend it a bit further to say 9/11 and what happened with the surveillance state after that period. But that kind of microcosm in American history of the Patriot militia movement of the 80s and 90s, you know, Soldier of Fortune magazine, of course, My Dear Old Uncle Bill, all of this stuff was very, very prominent. And you could say it's because it's when I was a kid. And so in a weird way, I'm nostalgic for the lunatic white supremacists of my day. Nick Fuentes is an entirely different animal compared to, you know, Bill Pierce. At least I understood Bill Pierce. And my therapist keeps telling me that I should stop telling people that. Anyway, today what we're going to discuss is Ruby Ridge. We're going to talk about Randy Weaver, because I just discovered, and I'm a bit embarrassed to admit that I didn't know that this happened when it happened, but when I look at the time period, I had just been kicked out of where I was living in Indianapolis, and I was living on couches and garages and benches and whatnot, so it's not unusual, I suppose, that I wasn't aware Randy Weaver died last year, but Randy died at age 74 last May, so it's been almost a year since we lost one of the great and weird figures of the 20th century, really. I think that my views on Randy are complicated, and we'll get into that a bit. I sort of gave a once over of the Ruby Ridge standoff way back in the first series on the show in the Bill Cooper trilogy, the first three episodes that I keep referencing and yet telling everyone to never go listen to. Because Ruby Ridge was sort of like the Fort Sumter of the 20th century in that it galvanized a lot of the right wing, which had been, you know, like toys strewn about a playroom for quite some time. You know, you had your proto-fascists over here. You had you had your neo-Nazis over here. You had the Aryan Nations. You had Christian Identity. You had Sovereign Citizens, Posse Comitatus, the Silver Shirts. All of these groups had been sort of functionally working in the United States for decades at this point, but they didn't often come together and coalesce around a thing other than, you know, we all hate the Jews and we want to get rid of the government. This was the first real event, especially that I can recall in my lifetime, the first of several, that would bring the fringe right together and thrust them into the mainstream, because, well, they weren't wrong in this particular case. And that's something that one of the reasons I decided to do this as an episode, not just because I really, really, really didn't want to talk about fucking Freemasonry, but because all of the coverage you see about Randy and the Weaver family and the Ruby Ridge standoff, which, by the way, is an erroneous name because Ruby Ridge isn't really a place. I mean, it's kind of a place, but it's also not where the house was. So the Ruby Ridge standoff actually took place elsewhere. But it's that in and of itself is sort of a microcosm of how the mainstream and therefore most of our perceptions about this event and this guy are kind of bullshit created by the federal government to justify the fact that they murdered half of his family because he refused to appear in court after they tried to entrap him to extract information about people that he knew. So Ruby Ridge is one of those events that is sort of landmark in a lot of the groups that I study and cover, and a lot of the people who influenced the weirdo internet space that I sort of was exposed to as a young person. You know, I think we talked about in the Bill Cooper trilogy how Ruby Ridge was kind of like a watershed moment for Bill Cooper in that that sort of marked the transition from fringe weirdo cat to overt constitutional absolutist, political figure, if you want to call Uncle Bill a political figure. The rage over Ruby Ridge, which only got worse later that year when Waco kicked off, because one of the things we're going to talk about is that Waco happened immediately after Ruby Ridge, and a lot of the federal agents in these two cases were the same people. So there was a lot of cause on the right for anger and backlash over what happened and how it was handled. And a lot of the latter part of the 1990s was in many ways a reaction to the events of Ruby Ridge and Waco. You had Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols kind of outright proclaiming that the way the federal government declared war on the American people at Ruby Ridge was part of why they committed the bombing of the Alfred P. Murrah building. Now, I have my theories that it was also tied to the execution of Richard Snell and the compound at Elohim City, and that's a whole other thing. But to listen to McVeigh and Terry Nichols tell it, the government declared war on the people of the United States of America at Ruby Ridge. The second shot fired was Waco, and that inspired an entire generation of angry white men to pick up books like the Turner Diaries and Unintended Consequences and learn how to take a shot at the government. And in many ways, what we're dealing with now is like the after effects of that. Most people would tell you that domestic terrorism in the United States is worse now than it's ever been. I wholeheartedly disagree, because if you can remember the 80s and the 90s, there were malicious standoffs with police and the ATF happening like every other month, and they would go on for weeks. The real concern over, now gun ban is just kind of like a thing people like Alex Jones throw around, because we have the example of the assault weapons ban of the 1990s to look at. You had Soldier of Fortune magazine allowing all of these cats to kind of co-mingle and communicate, and for the first time outside of like the cats who used the internet, which was not everyone in 1990, you had the ability to write things to Soldier of Fortune and have like-minded people see them. And it allowed sort of the creation of a community of these people. This was sort of like the impetus for survivalist culture, for, like I said, the militia movement. It was also really the impetus for the Second Amendment movement as we would understand it, as a reaction to gun legislation, the assault weapons ban, the establishment of a firearms registry, all of those kinds of things. The culture that was in opposition to that really formed up around Soldier of Fortune magazine, and a lot of those cats were very interested in the events of Ruby Ridge, because they started out with the government trying to entrap Randy Weaver by setting up a sale of firearms. So there was an intersection of what you would now come to think of as the standard fare for any right-wing event: your constitutional absolutist patriot types, the militia types, the racists, and all of those individual groups. This was the beginning of that turning into one big group. And as is usually the case, you can thank the federal government for that. So we're going to talk about who Randy Weaver was, who Vicky Weaver was, why they were where they were, what they were, and what happened and the differences between how it's usually covered and the truth. Because one of the things that I would really like to highlight today, and I'm going to catch flack for this, I understand it, but I don't actually think Randy Weaver was a white supremacist, and I don't just mean that because one of the first things that he said whenever he started established communications with agents during the standoff was, why is the news calling me a white supremacist? Those are not my beliefs. But also just because I understand how the federal government likes to frame people after they kill them. So I think that... We're gonna get heavy down on Ruby Ridge today, which is my escape hatch for not talking about the Freemasons and stonemasonry and, you know, the compass in the eye thing. So that's what's happening on the show today. Here we go. Now, as is usually the case, I'm not going to dwell much on childhood and upbringing here. Randy, who actually hated the name Randy and went by Pete, which I think is interesting, dropped out of college and enlisted in 1966. He was assigned to a Green Beret unit at Fort Bragg, and he met Vicky on leave in 1970. They married the following year. Most accounts seem to suggest that some of the family's more fringe beliefs actually came from Vicky, who was raised in an offshoot of Mormonism before she embraced millenarianism as an adult. We've talked a bit about millenarianism in the past. It's a form of eschatological fundamentalism that believes that an imminent catastrophic event that a small group of believers will survive is going to take place. She was also, as best as I can tell from the way Sarah and Rachel, their two daughters, there's also a third daughter named Elishaba, but she was an infant at the time, described their upbringing, the family was probably Christian identity, which explains some things and calls some other things into question. Reports that Randy had been attending meetings at the Aryan Nations at Dick Butler's Hayden Lake compound, for example, do make some sense when one considers that the Hayden Lake compound was closely tied to the Church of Jesus Christ Christian, the Christian Identity denominational church overseen by the Reverend Peter J. Peters. He of the unfortunate name that we've discussed a few times in the past. He had a radio show on WWCR, and he was actually the pastor of the church attended by most of the members of the Brüderschweigen. And I mentioned in the intro that most accounts would label the Weavers as white supremacists, despite nobody in the family claiming to be one. Most Christian idents and the Weavers, from as best as I can tell, are white separatists. White separatists don't consider themselves to be white supremacists. For the most part, they just don't believe in race mixing and, in some cases, race mingling. The Weaver girls have variously described growing up with a kosher diet, practicing the holy days on Fridays, and a belief that Hebrews aren't Jews, which is Christian identity, even if they were too young to recognize it as such. And a combination of Vicky's millenarian belief that the world was going to end, and the white separatist Northwest territorial imperative, is what brought the Weavers to the hills in Boundary County, Idaho. We've discussed the Northwest Imperative on the show before. It was a plan that was introduced in the 1970s to migrate and settle in Washington, Oregon, Idaho, and Montana. In some cases, Wyoming and Northern California as well, which should explain Northern California, if you've ever been there. and establish or gradually create a white ethnostate by everyone moving to these areas and then having 5 to 10 children apiece. Part of why the Northwest Territorial Imperative chose the Northwest as what they called a white American bastion of yeoman farmers, if you're familiar with Robert J. Matthews, was that it was remote and difficult to navigate, which would make it difficult for the federal government to uproot them once they dug in. But also, because of its proximity to the Canadian border and the ease with which you can set up a homestead with considerable land to hunt and fish. Which, you know, fucking Idaho. White separatists believe, generally speaking, that by pooling their funds and resources and aggressively outbreeding non-white people, they can achieve an ethnostate. The Northwest Imperative can frequently be found in conversations about white genocide, 2044, or anything related to the idea that white people are going extinct. It was referenced in Dylann Roof's manifesto, for example. The ADL contends that white separatists are white supremacists, although the group itself does not consider itself to be. The difference to separatists is that they don't want to dominate other races, they just don't want to interact with them either. And, you know, controversial opinion perhaps, but I'm fucking fine with that. If there are white people who never want to talk to me, that's fantastic. And if they want to move to rural Montana, even better, I wasn't going there anyway. So, it's fair to say that, you know, white separatism is racist, and so is Christian identity as a movement. And so it's a safe assumption that Randy and Vicky were racists, but I think the conflation with Nazis and the Aryan nations is sort of a convenient demonization technique for the government to utilize so that the public will be less outraged at the fact that they killed half of them. We talked about the propaganda tactic of reductio ad Hitlerum, or playing the Nazi card, on our propaganda episode. It's a form of fallacy of irrelevance that suggests that your proximity to Adolf Hitler's ideologies or the ideologies of the Nazis invalidates your opinions. And in that way, the federal government really sought to invalidate the humanity of the Weaver family by spending 30 years telling everyone that they were Nazis. You can actually hear Bill Maher mocking the fact that they were killed and that the government killed their dog 3 days after it happened. But then, Bill Maher's not a great example of how people behave. He's kind of a monster that runs on smugness and human misery. And, you know, frankly, the handling of the Weaver, let's call it a situation, by the federal government gave considerable cause for spin. To say that the situation was botched would be a fucking understatement. Allegedly, the FBI were first made aware of the Weavers when their neighbor made a report that Randy threatened to kill the Pope. I think that's debatable. Randy ran for mayor in 1988, and as we discussed back in our COINTELPRO and American Fascism episodes in the pilot season, the federal government at least used to keep a fairly close eye on the Christian identity movement. In 1989, Randy attended a conference at Hayden Lake, and he met a man named Gus Magisano. Gus subsequently visited the Weaver's home, not the location of the standoff, but where the Weavers had been living originally. A much smaller apartment closer to, well, other people. Magisano and Weaver developed a rapport, and eventually, Magisano asked Weaver to sell him two modified sawed-off shotguns. It's important to note, Weaver did not solicit this sale, by the way. He sold Magisano the guns, and in December of 1990, Weaver received felony weapons charges. Gus Magisano was an undercover FBI agent named Ken Fadley. After realizing that a federal agent had been to their home, the Weavers moved to a much more remote, strategically defensible position in the Selkirk Mountains, where the standoff would eventually take place. The FBI attempted to leverage Weaver's felony charges for information about people that he knew at the Hayden Lake compound that were associated with the Aryan Nations. Weaver was known to associate with several members of the group, as well as people associated with the Covenant, the Sword, and the Arm of the Lord, another group associated with the Christian Identity Movement that was prominent in anti-government and survivalist circles. It was also associated with the Bruderschweigen, who founded their group at the Hayden Lake compound. Richard Snell, whose execution I mentioned, I believe, prompted the bombing of the Alfred P. Murrah building, was also a CSA member, and their compound at Elohim City was actually purchased from Campus Crusade for Christ, which is tied to Tim LaHaye and the Left Behind series, and also Warner Brothers Entertainment. It's just amazing sometimes to look at how all of these things are interconnected. So, the interstate intersectional traffic that was going through Hayden Lake was obviously of interest to the feds, who saw Weaver as a way to get information on what was ostensibly a hub for white extremism in a burgeoning ethno-state migration movement. Only, here's the thing, Weaver didn't cooperate. He refused to give information on anyone. His wife wrote several very strongly worded letters about how the federal government was poisoning the children of Yeshua to the United States Attorney's Office, and they completely stonewalled any attempts at gaining information about the activities going on at Hayden Lake from Randy Weaver. Stubborn old son of a bitch. The reports from the FBI state that Agent Fadley and Weaver would often discuss war with the ZOG, the Zionist-occupied government. We've talked about the ZOG conspiracy in the past. It's linked to the Protocols of the Elders of Zion and the Christian Identity Movement. It has roots in Arnold Liese's Jewish government rhetoric from before the Second World War and the British Imperial Fascist League of the 1920s. ZOG rose to prominence in 1976 and really became common right-wing extremist lexicon in 1978 with Bill Pierce's Turner Diaries. ZOG was also used as the name of the target of the Bruderschweigen in 1984 during their War in 84 campaign of bombings and bank robberies. But here's the thing. I don't know that I believe Randy Weaver had any interest in the ZOG. By the time he had been investigated by the FBI, Randy had been banned from the Aryan Nations compound at Hayden Lake for drinking beer, something they didn't let you do, and he was known amongst the group for getting into arguments with neo-Nazis about their anti-Semitism. So, I don't know that I believe this is a guy who was getting into conversations about how they needed to hoard weapons to fight a Jew-run government because he was arguing with neo-Nazis about how there wasn't a Jew-run government. This is, if you refer back to the pilot season, once again, we did an episode on the Weathermen Underground as sort of like an addendum to our series on COINTELPRO, right? And one of the things that was noted by several members of the Weathermen Underground, Bernie Dorn and several other members of the group noted that the FBI sent infiltrators into their group who then encouraged them to become more violent, to build bombs, who offered to give them the supplies necessary to commit violent acts so that they could then be prosecuted for committing violent acts. And I kind of believe that that is exactly what was going to happen here. This is a guy who had some weirdo beliefs, who intentionally isolated himself from everyone because he had some weirdo beliefs. And the FBI sought him out, entrapped him, and then tried to rev him up with ideas about committing acts of domestic terrorism so that they could use him to arrest other domestic terrorists. And sometimes I really have to wonder if there are any domestic terrorists who are not linked to the FBI or the CIA. Just like, I wonder if there are any drug cartels or drug dealers who are not in some way linked to the CIA. Because, as we've discussed at the beginning of this season, all crime really traces back to the federal government somehow. And as far as Weaver's radicalization, we have proof positive that this is a guy who didn't move to the location where the standoff took place until he realized that he was being monitored by the federal government for gun racketeering or whatever the fuck. Something that he wasn't doing until the federal government asked him to. So when we look at all of the news coverage of Randy Weaver as a radical right-wing white supremacist who was selling guns to the Aryan Nations or whatever, almost none of that was the case until the federal government got involved. He was just a weirdo who lived somewhere in bugfuck rural Idaho who liked drinking occasionally with neo-Nazis, who he would then argue with. And look, I'm not defending the guy. Normal people don't like drinking with neo-Nazis, but it doesn't change the fact that he was just kind of an alcoholic who thought some stupid shit before the FBI tried to turn him into a terrorist, and whenever they failed at that, they created a standoff that lasted for a week and a half and murdered half of his family. I think I mentioned this up top, but Ruby Ridge didn't actually happen at Ruby Ridge. It actually happened in Caribou Ridge. The press just doesn't care about accuracy, and Ruby Ridge sounds better. Caribou Ridge is 10 miles from the nearest incorporated town, Bonner's Ferry. The Weavers had no electricity. The children were homeschooled. They grew and hunted all their own food. Randy was actually the only one who interacted with anyone outside the family, and that was mostly because he liked to drink and argue with people, from what I've gathered. So, the Weavers had no telephone, and they didn't directly receive mail service either. This is relevant, because corresponding with the Weavers was, by design, a one-sided affair. So once Randy was dealing with lawyers and court documents and a probation office, problems were inevitable. In February, after the felony charges were filed, the Weavers themselves filed an affidavit alleging that personal enemies were using the FBI to provoke an altercation that would result in their deaths. Prescient. The initial claims against Weaver made by federal agents alleged that he was involved with bank robberies and had a history of violent felony charges. And none of that was true. Weaver had never even been a suspect in any bank robberies, and as far as we know, the subject was never even broached before he met Agent Fadley. Ultimately, Weaver would be charged with making modifications to firearms outside of legal regulation, and he was arrested when ATF agents faked a car accident and Randy and his wife Vicky stopped to help them. Weaver posted bail, and he was given a trial date of February 19th and appointed an attorney and a probation officer. Contacting Weaver was attempted, but futile, so when the date of the trial was moved on February 5th to the 20th, it's not likely anyone had a way to notify Randy other than via letters sent to one of his neighbors. And the letter that the court did send Weaver also misprinted the date as March 20th. So on February 20th, when Randy didn't show up for court and his lawyer and probation officer hadn't heard from him in over a month, a bench warrant for failure to appear in court was issued. 6 days later, U.S. Marshals, the probation office, and the presiding judge were all made aware of the clerical error in the letter sent to Weaver giving him the wrong date, but the judge refused to withdraw the warrant nonetheless. U.S. Marshals tasked with arresting Weaver were merely told that he was associated with anti-government extremist groups, stockpiled weapons, and he would refuse arrest by force. Weaver himself had been informed by his probation officer that if he were convicted, the government could take his land and his children away. So negotiations for a peaceful surrender were initiated by U.S. Marshals on March 5th, but the U.S. Attorney's Office ordered them suspended in October and redirected through Weaver's probation officer, who he now refused to speak with. Marshals then began surveillance of the Weaver residence to plan Randy's capture for failure to appear in court. A threat source profile was developed on Weaver. This profile has since been criticized by a Senate Judiciary Committee for its inadequate and inaccurate depiction of Weaver and the threat that he posed. Because Weaver wouldn't negotiate with who he was asked to negotiate with, several people tapped to negotiate with the Weavers, like Dick Butler himself at one point, actually, were assessed as significantly more radical than Randy himself, and the information about how he would react came partially from them, based on what they do. Weaver's psychological profile was completed by someone who conducted no in-person assessment of him, and erroneously referred to him as Mr. Randall throughout the work. A memo circulated through the Justice Department described Weaver as a Green Beret turned extremist whose property had been booby-trapped and laced with hidden tunnels and weapons caches, and that he would shoot intruders on sight. This was exacerbated by false reports, or, you know, lies, from Geraldo fucking Rivera, who claimed that he had chartered a helicopter for a flyover of the Weaver's property, and Randy had shot at the pilot. Now, no shots were heard or reported, Weaver denied the claim, and the pilot, when interviewed by the FBI, said no shots had been fired at him, but allegations that Weaver had shot at a helicopter were used as justification for the authorization of deadly force in Randy's capture, and after the siege ended by the U.S. Marshals as justification for killing a 14-year-old boy and his fucking dog. So, I think sometimes it'd be interesting to sit down with a piece of paper and calculate roughly how many people Geraldo Rivera's bullshit sensationalism masquerading as journalism has gotten killed since the 1980s. Anyway, The clusterfuck that was Operation Northern Exposure began on August 21st, 1992, based on federal entrapment, a fake psych profile, misprinted court documents, an inaccurate threat assessment profile based on information from neo-Nazis who'd never met Randy, and a lie from Geraldo fucking Rivera. As is usually the case, there are two versions to every story. There's the version that the U.S. Marshals tell you of the series of events, and then there's the version that Randy and his family tell you of the events. I'll give you some of both and let you decide what you think happened. According to the U.S. Marshals, six marshals, let's call it snuck, onto the Weavers' property to assess appropriate locations with which to extract Weaver in the event of his capture with minimal casualties. Because again, these were people operating under the assumption, the false assumption, that this was a property that was covered with landmines, with huge weapons caches and tunnels for escape routes all over it. One of the marshals claims that he threw a series of rocks, two rocks, at the side of the house to see if the dogs inside would react to them. Which they did, of course. The dogs came running outside. At which point the marshals retreated back into the woods, trying to avoid being seen. One of the friends of the family, Kevin Harris, and Randy's son, Sammy, came outside to see what had spooked the dogs. One of the marshals shot the dog, at which point Sammy opened fire on the marshals, and the marshals shot his arm off. After he'd been shot, Sammy turned around, ran back toward the house, screaming, "Dad, I'm coming home," and was shot in the back several times. When the kid was shot in the back, Kevin Harris shot at the marshals and killed one of the marshals. Now, the marshals will tell you that this was all sort of accidental. They were not aiming for the kid whenever he was running away. No one was trying to shoot him in the back. Shooting the dog was accidental. All of these things were not on purpose. I submit to you that a military operation that they spent 8 months planning drew out the dog. They killed the dog, which drew out the kid. Then they killed the kid. And when the parents came outside to investigate what happened to the kid, they shot the mom in the face. Does that sound accidental to you? It seems to me that that's exactly how you would, by chain of command, take out a family. You shoot the dog to bring out the kid. You shoot the kid, which causes hysterics in the adults. Then you shoot the wife, which causes the husband to stop thinking rationally. That's not an accident. I mean, okay, you could make an argument. You'd be lying to yourself because you need to tell yourself that the federal government did not intentionally entrap, lie about, target, and then assassinate several members of a family just because. But that's what fucking happened. It's also important to mention that these guys sneaking around the Weaver property in the middle of the night didn't identify themselves as U.S. Marshals until they'd killed the dog and the first gunfight began. Harris then returned to the Weaver's cabin to get Randy and Vicky, and the Marshals went to a neighbor's house to call for backup and medical assistance. Sammy's body was retrieved and placed in a guest cabin. Marshals contacted the ATF, the FBI, and local law enforcement for support in bringing in two adult men, one adult woman, a teenage girl, and two children. Your tax dollars at work, America. At the request of the marshals, Idaho Governor Cecil Andrus declared a state of emergency in Boundary County, mobilizing the National Guard, and the FBI in Washington, D.C. scrambled the hostage rescue team from Quantico. Eugene Glenn, an FBI agent from Salt Lake City, oversaw what became an operation consisting of several hundred law enforcement officers and still just Randy Weaver and his family and Kevin Harris. On August 22nd, the FBI drafted special rules of engagement for use in the Weaver standoff. From the Department of Justice, the special rules of engagement for the Weaver standoff were as follows. Quote, number one, if any adult in the area around the cabin is observed with a weapon after the surrender announcement has been made, deadly force could and should be used to neutralize the individual. Number two, if any male is observed with a weapon prior to the announcement, deadly force can and should be employed if the shot could be taken without endangering any children. Number three, if compromised by any dog, the dog can be taken out. Number four, any subjects other than Randy Weaver, Vicky Weaver, Kevin Harris presenting threat of death or grievous bodily harm, FBI rules of deadly force apply. Deadly force can be utilized to prevent the death or grievous bodily injury to oneself or that of another. End quote. And Eugene Glenn noted in his report of the event that the rules of engagement were modified from adult to adult male to exclude Vicky Weaver around 2:30 or 3 p.m. after consultation with Glenn because Vicky had not been seen at the site of the shootout where the U.S. Marshal had been murdered. And that's noteworthy because when Vicky was shot in the head, they had been ordered not to shoot Vicky. Vicky was actually shot while the family was viewing Sammy's body. Randy was shot in the shoulder, which sent the Weavers running back to the house. The sniper then shot Kevin Harris in the back, and this bullet went through Harris and into Vicky Weaver, who was carrying their 10-month-old daughter, Elishaba, at the time. The sniper responsible claimed he'd been aiming for Weaver's spine and missed. This sniper, Lon Horiuchi, was later involved in the siege at Waco, and would be tried with manslaughter for the murder of Vicky Weaver in 1997, but those charges would later be dropped because feds don't go to prison. A 542-page report on the siege at the Weaver home, conducted by a Department of Justice-created Ruby Ridge Task Force, determined that Horiuchi did not follow protocol in the use of deadly force, and he was later named in the wrongful death suit filed against the United States government by the Weaver family for the deaths of Vicky and Sammy. Of course, due to the Supremacy Clause of the U.S. Constitution, not much could really be done. Essentially, even though there was cause for criminal charges, federal rule being supreme law of the land supersedes a criminal court. Isn't the law neat? The same guy then shot into the Waco compound less than a month later, and I'm sure his psych profile wasn't practically written in crayon. After the fact, federal agents would claim they didn't know Vicky had been shot on the second day of an 11-day standoff in the summertime. But the use of deadly force was rescinded on August 26th after criticism arose that federal agents had been given shoot-on-site orders for a failure to appear bench warrant. All accounts concur that deadly force was unwarranted as well, except for Dianne Feinstein, who's been wrong about everything for time immemorial. After 11 days of the Weaver family barricaded inside their cabin with Vicky's body under the kitchen table, Randy agreed to speak with fellow Green Beret and white separatist Beau Gritz. Gritz was given 24 hours to negotiate a surrender or a tactical assault would be executed to remove Randy by force. Inside the home, both Randy and Kevin Harris had been shot, with gangrene and infection setting in, and with no electricity or medicine to treat the wounds. After mediation by Gritz, Randy Weaver finally surrendered on August 30th. He was flown to a hospital in Spokane, Washington, and Beau Gritz oversaw the removal of Vicky's body. Weaver's daughters were taken into federal custody. Consideration was given to charging Sarah, the oldest, as an adult and a co-conspirator, but no charges were ultimately made. The girls were then later released to Vicky's relatives. Randy and Kevin Harris were subsequently arrested. Weaver was arraigned September 1st, and his trial began in April of 1993. The defense called no witnesses and instead directly refuted the charges against Weaver with evidence. In July, Randy Weaver was acquitted of all charges except for the original failure to appear in court. He served 16 of an 18-month sentence and was released. Kevin Harris was acquitted of all charges, including shooting the U.S. Marshal. The Weaver family filed wrongful death charges in 1995 for the amount of $200 million, an out-of-court settlement of $1 million each for Weaver's daughters, and $100,000 for himself was reached in exchange for the government admitting no wrongdoing in the deaths of Sammy and Vicky Weaver. Kevin Harris sued as well and received a $380,000 settlement on behalf of the federal government. Anonymous sources within the Department of Justice indicate that the Weavers likely would have received the full amount if they'd proceeded to trial. The Weaver family later relocated to Kalispell, Montana, and Randy became something of a figurehead for the militia movement. He spent the rest of his life doing autograph signings at gun shows and occasionally appearing on shows like InfoWars talking about UFOs and the New World Order. Randy and Alex actually met during the latter's campaign to rebuild the Branch Davidian compound after the Waco siege. An event that, as I've mentioned, took place less than a month after the Weaver siege and involved many of the same federal agents. And these two events fairly created the modern American militia movement. After all, gun grabber conspiracies cite Randy Weaver as a real life example of federal attacks on the Second Amendment. And as I said at the top of the show, they're not wrong. The government targeted this guy, tried to radicalize him, then tried to squeeze him for information, then essentially decided to kill him for not cooperating, and spun it to the public that it was all okay because he was a Nazi. And in the process, they galvanized thousands into an anti-government movement that is probably never going to go away, because now they've got a martyr. Even if the entire situation was essentially manufactured by the feds and endorsed by the media, who have contended that an uncooperative white supremacist created the situation by refusing to cooperate with federal entrapment. All coverage makes much of the presence of neo-Nazis in the crowd at the press line during the siege, and the scene is painted as a right-wing coming-out party to distract everybody from the reality that the FBI and the ATF created this standoff just like they created the initial gun sale. From the Weaver incident, we get a feverish right-wing gun culture organized through Soldier of Fortune magazine, and the rest of the 90s were marked by multiple similar standoffs with the Covenant, the Sword and the Arm of the Lord, the Michigan Militia, Rainbow Farms, the Minutemen, and plenty of other fucking groups, citing the actions taken at Ruby Ridge as cause for violent resistance against the tyrannical government. In October of 1997, former FBI official E. Michael Cahoe was sentenced to 18 months in prison for obstruction in the Weaver case. Cahoe destroyed records from an after-action critique of the siege, which he did not disclose to defense attorneys. He claimed that he had a bad memory and didn't recall destroying the documents. He said he must have assigned the report to his confidential trash file, despite testimony from his subordinates that he had bragged about giving investigators, quote, a bunch of bullshit, end quote, when asked about the files after the trial in 1993. It took several years of accusation and a fucking polygraph test for Cahoe to remember any of this. Incidentally, he hadn't only forgotten that he deleted his own records, but also that he'd told the chief of violent crimes, Gail Evans, to destroy his records too. Despite this, he was pardoned and had his rights restored in 2002 by George W. Bush. Weaver's own words that he had been lied to by the government and had no reason to believe or trust any of its representatives, framed frequently as the sentiments of an extremist, look what they did to the guy! His wife's murder was joked about on television and chalked up to, quote, serious constitutional infirmities. They killed his son. They killed his dog. They sent him to prison and tried to charge him with selling them guns they asked him for. The shootout that killed his kid happened because federal agents were trespassing on his property in the middle of the night. And then the FBI authorized a kill team to shoot him on sight on his own property. Randy Weaver thought a lot of things that I disagree with. Things that I think are observably and provably wrong. His family were white separatists, which means that on some level, Randy was a racist. I don't think that justifies what happened to the Weaver family, though. And I think it says a lot about the big American illusion that not only can this happen, but it did, and most of the country just believes the government, despite that being an absolutely absurd fucking thing to do. The SPLC cites Ruby Ridge as a major demarcation point in the American militia movement. We all, those of us who were looking for it anyway, saw the New World Order at Ruby Ridge. But really, and this is where I break with the lunatic fringe, I guess. There is no New World Order. It's just the American government. The Sovereign Citizen Movement got fucking huge after Ruby Ridge. SOVCITs, as many of you are aware, don't recognize the authority of federal law enforcement and part of the Northwest Imperative, which overlaps with the American Redoubt movement and the Cascadia movement, both regionally and ideologically, and in the case of Cascadia, they have, like, the same fucking flag. One of the components of the imperative became violent opposition to federal organizations like the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management throughout the 90s. Ruby Ridge was a fucking fantastic and effective recruitment tool for all extremist groups because the hypochondriac got sick and the Weaver incident forever validated everything. You know, we talked about last season when we had our discussion about Christo-fascism, the presence of Christo-fascism in the United States of America and how Christo-fascism always leads to totalitarianism. One of the aspects of the implementation of Christo-fascism is fear. You need a population that is scared half to fucking death all the time, willing to give up its rights. And you know one of the ways that you scare the general public, public half to death all the fucking time? You radicalize a few thousand people into committing individual acts of domestic terrorism regularly for decades based on an event you manufactured, based on a bunch of lies you told about a guy you chose and then targeted and murdered half of his family. Seems like it's almost advantageous for this to have not been so much a botch as a targeted attack for the purposes of radicalizing lots and lots of fucking people into anti-government activity, something that we have evidence in the Weaver case the government was fomenting themselves at the time. So, what do we gather from all of this then? Is it that much like every other country's problem with terrorism and crime and violent political action, the federal government is really the cause of all of it here, too? Is it that perhaps we should look at the way media portrays figures like Randy Weaver, who, I will say once again, before the criticisms start to come in, I am not defending as a person. He was a racist. He thought a lot of dumb fuck things. You could listen to Randy Weaver talk about how he thought the United States government had been infiltrated by extraterrestrials on InfoWars with Alex Jones, who is trying to downplay the fact that this figurehead of the American militia movement is actually just a bug fuck crazy alcoholic from the woods in Idaho. So I'm not saying this was a good cat by any stretch of the imagination. Am I saying that the fact that he thought a bunch of stupid fucking things and was friends with people I would just as likely shoot as look at means that the federal government should have killed his son? No. I'm also suggesting perhaps that the federal government decided to kill his son so that a whole bunch of Nazis would have a thing to look at and say, this is why you need to join our groups, help us build these bombs and blow up these other buildings, so that the federal government can then look at all of the rest of us and say, we have a domestic terrorism problem, we're gonna need you to pay more taxes so that we can put more security in place so that the Nazis that we radicalize don't try to kill you when you go to church. And frankly, because this shit was happening primarily in rural areas all over the country, it went unchecked for decades, except for the handful of times whenever one of these groups or an individual got into a shootout with the police that went on for weeks at a time. It went completely the fuck unchecked until you had events like Charlottesville happening, where the police effectively were stood down by militiamen because at this point there's more of them and they have most of the guns. Now, you can ask yourself if that's on purpose or if it's a happy accident. Either way, it's not good for everybody who doesn't look like Randy Weaver. And it's, again, entirely the fault of the federal government, no matter which way you slice it, whether they did it on purpose or whether they took advantage of it after they realized that they fucked up in a way that they could benefit from. Because ultimately, most of these anti-government groups have the exact same goals as the federal government. Fuck everybody who isn't white, make all of the money, hoard all of the power, and take control of as much land as you possibly can. It's almost like they're the same fucking people. And to that end, every single person who tells you about what a crazy bugfuck extremist Randy Weaver was, every single white person I know is related to one of these. Every single fucking one of you has an Uncle Tim, or an Uncle Dan, or an Uncle Randy who thinks a lot of stupid fucking things and says them out loud when he gets too drunk because he spends all of his time watching InfoWars by himself since his wife left him, and other than going out with the boys and shooting rats at the fucking junkyard, he doesn't go out. We all know this guy. America is full of this guy. And that's part of the problem, because even though the actions taken against Randy Weaver are not justifiable, people who think like Randy Weaver are still kind of a problem when you have, what are we at now, 100 million of them? I think it's what, like a third now, right? So that's not great. And as we discussed in the cult episode, deprogramming isn't real. So I don't know how you fix that besides... No, re-education is really just deprogramming, and again, it doesn't really work. So, unless you want to kidnap 100 million people and chain them to the bed and try to fix what the government did to their minds, I really don't know what we do. Honestly, I for one think Cuba looks nice. You know, perhaps there's land in Ireland that's available. They have a very lovely coast. I don't know. But I think that what you have here is an intentional dumpster fire. You know, living in Pennsylvania, I've learned about some interesting landmarks and local things. And there's a place in Pennsylvania called Centralia. Some of you who are a bit of the more nerdy types might be familiar with Centralia, because I think it was the town that the Silent Hill game was based on. There's a coal mine under Centralia, Pennsylvania that caught fire. I don't know when, and this is entirely off the cuff because I can't really see right now, so I'm not gonna look it up, but Centralia caught fire, and it's been on fire for like decades at this point. The government has revoked their zip code, their postal code, they've rerouted the highway around them, and they've even offered like money to everyone living there to relocate. There's still a handful of people who live there because that's just peak Pennsylvania. Hey, so there's a fire that's never going to go out under you, and we've removed everything from the town. Well, no one tells me when I leave. That's just how it is here. But the point is, that Centralia, that fire that's self-feeding, that's never going to go out under that town, that's the United States of America. The people who founded this country founded a business model, not a country, a business model based around fear, mind control, not literal brainwashing, but thought policing. Mind control, Christo-fascism with an outline of totalitarianism that everyone living in the open-air prison would be so convinced of their own ability to do whatever they want, they would have no idea they have no actual rights at all. And we've built on that and built on that, and we've made it more complex by adding the intelligence apparatus, because what does any society need besides people whose entire purpose is espionage? What could go wrong? So we added that, and we've institutionalized scientifically studied and perfected racism as a system. We've implemented patriarchy in ways that have more layers than a fucking lasagna. And after about 400 years of unchecked social experimentation for the use and implementation of fascism and business nationalism on behalf of like 30 dudes, we have this. And you have people who walk around looking at it like, well, I mean, we can fix this with a vote, right? Like, we've been dumping bleach into the drinking water for 75 years, but like, we just need AOC. She wears those suits so well. What the fuck is wrong with you people? This country is run by lunatics whose lunacy is defined by the fact that No, I'm not going to do that because it's not lunacy, Mox. What's happening isn't insanity. It's the opposite of insanity. It's deliberate. It's intentional. It's actually a thing that a bunch of cats went out there and studied to figure out how to do. This country sent people to other countries to learn how to be better at fascism. A thing that we don't take credit for, but we kind of helped invent. Okay, fine. The Roman Catholic Church had a very, very large hand in things, but I think Italy gets a lot of credit for coming up with shit that a poet wrote down that we've been doing here for like 250 years already. And this seems unrelated to some of you, I'm sure, but the fact is, the United States is not broken, and I can throw you hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of examples of this. Randy's just a really, really good one, because there's nothing you can point at in this situation and say, well, maybe maybe it wasn't entirely their fault. The best you have is reductio ad Hitlerum. For a guy who openly and quite vocally was not a Nazi and liked to get drunk and argue with them because he thought anti-Semitism was stupid. Probably because he was a product of the American education system and didn't realize that he himself was anti-Semitic, but that's another conversation for another day, and we already have an hour and a half on that somewhere in season two that you can go back and listen to. So, I guess what I'm saying is we all should probably get passports and leave. Bear in mind, it's going to cost you $3,000 to expatriate and you immediately lose the right to own firearms. But, I think maybe the experiment's over. This is what I'm saying. I think maybe we should stick a fork in her. I don't know. So now that I've dug that narrative hole for myself, that's what I've got for you today. Cats, cadets, and kittens. If you liked this for some reason, I don't know, maybe you go to sleep listening to Doomsday Preachers, you can become a member of the illustrious and ever-growing Hep Cult. And you can do so by going to www.patreon.com/comeandseepod. And for as little as $5 a month, you can support the podcast and me, help me pay some bills and put food on the table. And all subscribers to the Patreon page will receive a download link for the Uncle Bill mixtape, which you've heard, if you've been listening this season, you've heard 3 or 4 of the 10 songs that are on that. It's a mixtape that I put together in between season 3 and 4 with some Bill Cooper audio samples and some sort of 90s hip-hop style-esque beats of various sorts. If you've been listening to the show, you're aware that that's kind of the aesthetic, and Bill Cooper is kind of a heavy inspiration on the show, if me yelling about Ruby Ridge for 10 minutes wasn't an indication anyway. So you can scoop that up over there, and likewise, if you would like to drink and or wear your support for the Come and See podcast, you can do that by going to comeandseemerch.bigcartel.com, where you can pick up the Come and See t-shirt that's currently available. I'm working on a design for a hoodie right now because it's almost spring and I don't do anything at the time frame that I'm supposed to. But that's available for you there. And also, our coffee collaboration with Black Forge Coffee Company, Behold a Dark Roast, another Bill Cooper reference for you there. It's a fantastic blend. It's an espresso blend. The first batch of that has gone out, and all indications seem to be that people dig it. I dig it. I also dig Black Forge Coffee Company. We ship them over here at Come and See. So I recommend that you go over there and pick up a bag of that and do that thing. So that's all the businessy type things that I think I have for you today. Having said that, we'll be back. Same Mox time, same Mox channel. I think a lot of you are going to be excited for the next episode of the show. Sorry the last two have been a bit short, but I'm still sort of coming back into my full powers. But I'm hoping that the dive we do on the next episode makes up for the last two shorter episodes. On the next episode of the show, we're going to talk about something that some of you have been up my ass about covering since I started this show. We're going to do Bohemian Grove. That's right. We're doing it. Buy weed. You'll need it. Get ready for that. I think that'll be out on Friday, but it might be out on Saturday. We'll see. Or it might be out tomorrow. You never really know with me. You never really know. But it'll be out soon, and when it is, you'll be able to get hep on that business. But in the meantime, concentrate on the hep, everybody. I have been Moxie O'Brien. This has been Come and See. And I will catch all of you hepcats on the flip side. Smooches, deuces, dig it.
You gotta stand up for it and be willing to die. You know, freedom isn't free. And this is a perfect example right here.
Finished.